It's Your Money with the investor coach, Paul Nickel. The show that pulls back the curtain on the financial services industry and exposes the truth about the traditional financial planning model. Paul believes education plus understanding leads to clarity and confidence that can and will lead to peace of mind. He uses simple solutions grounded in academic research from leading financial minds at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and the University of Chicago, including several Nobel laureates. You do not need to know everything if you have an investor coach teaching you the few right things. Paul Nickels is the president of Financial Abundance, a registered investment advisor. He is a member of the National Ethics Bureau, the Better Business Bureau, and a member of Strategic Coach. Get ready for some common sense clarity coaching with the investor coach, Paul Nickels.
Good morning. I hope this finds you well. Hope you're having a wonderful Saturday. This is Paul Nickels, the investor coach, and we are going to pull back the curtain on the financial services industry and expose the truth about money and investing. I'm running solo this morning without Luke Miller. Luke had some extra time off, so I'm in here by myself today. I hope this finds you all well. This is pre-recorded, by the way. It's not live. We have a live show coming up pretty soon. But if you've been listening to the show, and I know you have because we have been getting a lot of very positive and encouraging feedback from many of you. Thank you so much. You know that we want to focus on an academic approach to investing. And what we normally do every week is a market update, which I'm going to do first thing this morning, followed up by just some news that I've picked up, some tidbits here and here and there that I thought many of you may find interesting and enriching. So I'm going to get into that a little bit. And then I want to focus on the 20 must-answer questions for creating lasting peace of mind. Many folks have heard me talk about this and have had there's been inquiries about the 20 must-answer questions, which you can get a copy from us if you email Luke at Luke, L-U-K-E, at E-D, that's ed-inc.com, and he can get you a copy of the 20 must-answer questions. And when we talk about these 20 must-answer questions, we're really talking about 20 answers that you need to obtain, which is all you will never, ever need to know to be a savvy, intelligent, and investor. You will not have to trust anymore. Although trust is not a bad thing, boy, but trust is a lot better when you know exactly what you're doing and why. So anyway, if we're going to close out the show with that today, if we have time, the 20 must-answer questions. In the interim, I'm going to dive right into the market update, which I think is interesting. Now, we've had a rocky week. Now, this is as of Monday. So last Monday, it's Saturday morning as you're listening to this. So last Monday was when the market update was done. And as of Monday, the market was down in some spots. So we don't know how it's recovered in this last week. Hopefully it's bounced back. But the previous week was a little rocky as well. Now, why do we do this market update? Well, I need to set this up because it's very important to understand. We believe in an academic approach to investing. We deal with institutional investing using broad-based diversification. What does that mean? Well, basically what that means is we're using institutional funds, but we're utilizing a broad-based diversification component, meaning that we believe the market's efficient and we want to own it all. In fact, I'm going to go through the three parts that really make up what an academic approach to investing, or a structured approach, if you will. You've probably heard of active management, and you've heard of passive management. Active management is, chasing the market, trying to anticipate where the moves are going to be, try to buy and sell and stay ahead of the curve. A passive approach would be one where someone would maybe buy an index fund and hold it. It's more of a buy and hold type of approach. Well, a structured approach utilizes academic information for the last 50 some odd years, academics from leading universities all around the country, and some Nobel laureates. And what all this science basically equates to is something called free market portfolio theory. I'm going to take a few minutes to break this down, as I do every week, because until you understand the philosophy here, the market update may or may not mean that much to you. Hopefully, you have a very well-diversified portfolio, and every market segment is something that you would be interested in knowing about to see how your portfolio is doing as a whole. So, what are the three components that make up free market portfolio theory? Well, The first one is that free markets work. See, we believe that the market is efficient, that the price of a good or service is already factored in to the share price of that stock, and that the free market dictates that, which is why some of us have been a little bit concerned about the government involvement in the last going on a year now, because when the government gets involved, then it takes away the free market component, or it could. But we believe the market's efficient, and based on supply and demand, free markets are the best determinant of market prices. Now, why is it important to understand this? Folks, it's very important that you decide which camp you're in. There's two camps out there, basically. One camp believes the market's efficient, and then that you can't really predict with any consistency what's going to happen in the market. So you just buy it and hold it all. There's another group out there that believes that the market is inefficient, and that studious people that may be in the know or have access to some information that the rest of us don't can ascertain what's going to happen in the market, predict it, and thereby increase value for doing that. Well, the challenge is the science doesn't prove that out, but it does prove that there's a very small percentage of money managers that do beat the market consistently, about 15%. So what about the other 85% that don't? It's very difficult to do. See, we believe the market's efficient. You want to buy it all and hold it. That leads us to our second component, which we believe is vital. In fact, it's proved out over and over again. This is what Harry Markowitz, William Sharpe, and Merton Miller won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1994, and that is modern portfolio theory. Diversification works. See, Markowitz won the Nobel Prize in 1990 for a paper that he had written in 1952 for his PhD. And what he really focused on was this concept of dissimilar price movement. You might have heard of the term correlation. But dissimilar price movement, what Markowitz studied and figured out was that if he bought one stock or asset class, one stock unto itself may be a little risky. But if he could find another stock that had dissimilar movement from that stock, then he would buy them both and lower the volatility. Let me give you a picture of that. A picture of that would be, for example, you've got a suntan lotion company stock. Well, you know, that's good in the summer, and it's good when the sun shines. It depends on where you live, I guess. But it's not always going to be up because the sun doesn't always shine. But at the same time, you could own an umbrella company, a company that made umbrellas, and you realize that when the sun's not shining, well, you can take advantage of when it's raining. Now, this is a very simple example, but it really holds true, and that is we believe that you want to own the entire market, and then within that, practice modern portfolio theory, which basically says own all the asset classes, especially if they have dissimilar price movement. So, for example, you want to own everything there is to own out there, large companies, small companies, value companies, growth companies, cash, market, in the market, you know, stocks and bonds, etc. And the idea of modern portfolio theory is, and this is really where the industry, I think, in my opinion, drops the ball for the most part, and that is practicing modern portfolio theory. One of the key components of modern portfolio theory is the concept of rebalancing. Now, unfortunately, when you look at active management, active managers are chasing the asset classes that are up. For example, emerging markets are up right now. So let's say small companies are down right now. Well, it wouldn't be unrealistic to think that an active manager would sell all the shares of the small company because they're down and buy shares of emerging markets because it's up. Now, the challenge with this is that then you're always buying high and selling low. But when you're chasing the market, that's what you have to do. And of course, there's a lot of cost involved in that as well. But really, the idea of modern portfolio theory is to own all the asset classes all the time, and then to rebalance and get them back to their targets. So let's say, for example, that emerging markets is up and it represents 10% of your portfolio, but because it's up, now it represents 20%. Well, what the industry would do as a whole, the active managing, would be buy more of it. And then you have this huge weighting in your portfolio of emerging markets. Well, we believe that's a mistake. What we believe you should do is rebalance on a regular basis, sell off 10% of it, which gets it back to its target, and you're going to sell 10% of it at its peak. And then go ahead and buy whatever else is low. Let's say small caps are low, so it's going to be a smaller percentage than what the target should be in the portfolio. So we're going to buy more of it to get it back on track. This is the key to modern portfolio theory, and this is where I believe the industry and active management drops the ball, because they're constantly chasing the market. Now, it's true that they may gain by chasing the market and get some gain by doing that, but it really doesn't speak to all the cost involved of making those trades, buying and selling, and constantly turning over in that portfolio. So modern portfolio theory is the second component. The third component is the three-factor model. Now, the three-factor model, 15, 16, 18-year-old study, something like that, two professors from different universities figured out where 96% of the variabilities of returns come from. And they called this study the three-factor model. And it's proven out. What they wanted to figure out was, where exactly do the returns come from, and where exactly am I going to get a risk premium for that particular asset class? In other words, they figured out where the returns come from and about what you can expect in return by owning those asset classes. So they figured out something called the three-factor model, which basically says market factor, you need to have money in the market and in cash. Size factor, you need to have large companies and small companies. Small companies have historically returned higher, but with more risk. And then you want to own value companies. Value companies, which are distressed companies, not bad companies, but distressed companies. At the same time, you want to own growth companies. So with all that being said, we believe the market's efficient. We want to own it all. We want to practice modern portfolio theory and the three-factor model, which leads us to why we do the market update every week. And that is to figure out where exactly is the market as a whole. You can't just look at the S&P or the Dow to figure out where the market is as a whole. You can look at that and figure out where large companies are, but not the market as a whole. So for the sake of time, let me pound through these here. We want to look at the Russell 2500 index, which measures the performance of small to mid-cap companies. Well, month-to-date, it's about 1%. But year-to-date, it's up about 6.5%. It's gone down a little bit since last week. So small to mid-caps are doing very well so far this year. Russell 2000 index, which measures small to micro. These are small to very, very small companies. And month-to-date, it's up 2%. But year-to-date, it's up 3.5%. So small and micro are both up. Russell 2000 value. This measures the performance of small-cap value companies. Not growth companies, but value companies. And it's not doing too well. Value companies, small and large, is really kind of sucking wind this month so far. It's negative 4% for the month or year to date. So Russell Value 2000 small caps are down a little bit. Same for Russell 1000 value large companies. It's down about to almost 3%. Which brings us to large cap growth, which is represented by the S&P 500. And year to date, we're up about 2%, but month to date, we're down. Well, not down, 0.23. So overall, when we look at the U.S. Universe, we have small to mid cap that's doing very well. And we have value companies, large and small, that aren't doing too hot. In fact, they're in the negative. And then large caps are only up a couple points. So if you own it all, it doesn't matter to you because you're catching what's up and what's down. But remember, investing in the market is like going up a flight of stairs with the yo-yo. It has consistently gone up. It has what we call a two-thirds bias, meaning two out of every years is up, one out of every three, two out of every three is up, one out of every three is down. So the market overall has gone up. Let's look at international real quick. Morgan Stanley Capital International Index, which is a free-floating market capitalization index that is designed to measure developed markets like Canada, Denmark, Finland, Norway, Portugal, to name just a few. And month-to-date, it's in the negative, but year-to-date, it's up 7%. So developed international markets are up about 7%. Then we go into emerging markets, which would be these emerging markets would not be developed markets like Argentina, Korea, Malaysia, Morocco, Philippines, name a few. Well, month to date, it's down about 3%, but year to date, it's up 32%. Absolutely rocking. Okay. And then we have the Morgan Stanley Capital, Europe, Australia, and the Far East, which is down for the month, but up for the year about 5.5%. So right now, what we have is small cap, micro cap, growth companies is doing well. Emerging markets is doing very well, and international is doing well. International as a whole is doing very well. And in the U.S. equity universe, small to small and mid-cap companies. Large and large value are kind of mediocre. Anyway, that's our market update for the week. Hopefully, this all makes sense to you. You can always go to our website and listen to rebroadcasts of the show by going to Financial Abundance Inc. That's INC.com. That's Financial Abundance Inc. .com, and we have radio shows on there, blogs, all kinds of information If you want more clarity, or you can always call us, 814-867-5745. Again, it's Paul Nichols, the Investor Coach. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to It's Your Money. This is Paul Nichols, the Investor Coach. I hope this finds you well this morning. Beautiful Saturday morning. This is pre-recorded. You're listening to FM Talk 103.7 and 970 WBLF AM. And, of course, It's Your Money, the show that pulls back the curtain on the financial services industry and exposes the truth about money and investing. I'm sure that you had a chance to listen to Tim Rogers and Ken Pasch this morning, which make up the rest of the Coach's Corner lineup. Every morning, the three of us coaches hit different areas. Tim obviously talks about real estate. Ken is the leadership coach, and he pulls back the curtain on issues in the employment arena. And, of course, we talk about finances, and we've been getting a lot of positive feedback on the different shows that we've been doing. Thank you again so much for listening, and we hope that, you know, the information we put together for you every week does enrich your life in some small way. You know, knowledge is power, and it's a lot more fun to know that you know than to not know, because, you know, there's a tremendous amount of information in this country, but there is a huge lack of clarity, and not just in this area, in many areas of our lives. And, you know, this makes me think of what I wanted to talk about this segment, which is, excuse me, really just focusing on some news that I've picked up along the way. And I thought this was kind of interesting. You know, when it comes to estate planning, most financial planners go out of their way to make sure clients have all the basic documents, you know, such as living trusts, pour over wills, power of attorneys, healthcare proxies, living wills, etc. But now many advisors are starting to talk to their clients about their cyber life. What does that have to do with estate planning? Well, given the growing financial aspects of the internet, it could mean a lot. Who knows the passwords to your bank accounts, brokerage accounts, etc.? What about for those of you that are on Facebook or Twitter or many of the other types of sites? Have you left a list of passwords somewhere or with someone? Do you have a trusted family member who has the list? Do you have a lockbox or a safe at home or a safety deposit box at the bank with this information? There are some electronic lockboxes that are also available, and you can name beneficiaries to these, just like you can do for other assets. So in the event people use the internet on a regular basis or who have passwords protected accounts, both financial and non-financial, you should plan for someone to be able to clean up this part of your estate upon your demise, God forbid. So, you know, here we are. You know, technology, once again, is changing the way we do things. You know, when you think about technology, especially in the financial services arena, I mean, there's more information available. But the mantra hasn't changed, has it? It's the same old mantra. Stocks, bonds, mutual funds, chase the market, stock picking, market timing, track record investing. None of those things work, but that's been the continued mantra, where in just about every area of our life we can see the impact of technology, but not really in the area of planning, with the exception of people being able to go on and manage their own accounts, which I would venture to say more often is bad than good, depending on where people are getting their information. But anyway, we do have to contend with technology. And as I get older, I want to fight it. But I've learned you got to embrace change. At least that's how it works. It reminds me of a story of an old couple. Oh, my goodness. This was way back in the 1800s. They were going to town to see the new train. And, you know, they hitched up their wagon and headed to town to the new station, the depot house that they had built there. And there was a large crowd amassed, and here comes a train around the corner. And Paul looks over at Ma and says, "My goodness, they're never going to get that thing stopped," you know, because of the weight. Well, of course, it did stop. And people got on and cargo on and off. And, you know, Ma and Pa are sitting there the whole time. And the horn goes off, you know, the whistle, and smoke starts to bellow out. And Paul looks at Ma and says, "Well, They got it stopped, but they're never going to get it started. You know, it's funny. It's kind of like, you know, way back in the advent of automobiles, it was believed that you couldn't go over, I believe it was 25 or 30 miles an hour to take your breath away. But funny how things change, isn't it? Talking about major change, I've got to read this to you. And pardon my reading, but it's just too much information to do it otherwise. But this is kind of interesting. Who would have thought after 100 years a company as big and as powerful as General Motors would find itself in bankruptcy? There is no use trying to place blame. There's plenty to go around. Management, dealers, consumers, labor unions, government, etc. The company was once so important to the American economy that in 1953, Charles Wilson, known as Engine Charlie, then president of GM, said, "What's good for the country is good for General Motors and vice versa." That was the later paraphrase by the Little Abner comic character, General Boomoose. What's good for General Boomoose is good for the world. And I want to share some thoughts regarding this monumental event, but we urge everyone to look past the GM situation to the much broader context of what this might mean. You know, the focus has been on labor unions and the benefits that have extracted over the years. Their strikes have been precise, have always been crippling, and for the most part have led to significantly higher benefits. Some of those benefits were a little difficult to fathom, like workers receiving overtime even though they did not work 40 or more hours. The United Auto Workers Union was once 1.5 million members strong and now just has below 500,000 members. Its relevance has decreased dramatically over the past 30 years, along with its membership, at least outside of the auto industry. Today, the union owns 55% of Chrysler and 17.5% of GM, mostly through their retirement health plan. When you are the majority owner of Chrysler and a significant shareholder is GM, do you want to go and strike against yourself? In brokering the GM bankruptcy, President Obama got the UAW to agree to a wage freeze and no strike clause until 2015. Apparently, the UAW figures that by then the company will have either be dead or or there won't be anything to strike against, or it'll be back on its feet, strong, and they'll have the ability to strike if they choose. You know, this all gets a little cumbersome because if the union is unable to come up with an agreement with the management that will be selected by the government could actually force the union members to go back to work for a cooling off period. In other words, a major owner, the union, could strike against management at the same time. The majority owner could actually force them back to work if the union fails to realize that things have changed significantly and that they continue to focus only on protecting jobs. We fear that as time goes along, the profitability, if any, of a new GM will not be nearly as significant as it might have been. In fact, rather than emerging from bankruptcy as a new company with new opportunities, GM could emerge simply as the old company with a lot of Band-Aids and be so badly wounded that it will never have a chance to survive with any type of quality after bankruptcy. Can you say merger with Ford? The big lesson here is that the union, which still plays an important role for the American worker, needs to understand that the world is much different in the 21st century than it was in the 20th century. From management standpoint, a series of missteps over the years led to GM slowly shedding long-time automobile lines like Oldsmobile. They should have seen the writing on the wall and reacted decades ago. Unfortunately, they wanted to keep things as they were, not as they were going to be. Management certainly shipped a lot of jobs overseas, especially to China, where labor costs were significantly lower. While the union blames management for abandoning the American workers, and perhaps part of that is true, the fact is that management is beholden to the shareholders, and shareholders demand profits. One of the biggest costs is the assembly of the automobile. Even in the age of modernization, the cost of labor is the biggest cost there is when it comes to building an automobile, particularly those costs associated with taking care of retired workers. This overwhelmed fixed cost per car was simply burying GE, and other car manufacturers, which caused them to move the work overseas to find the best labor rates. It sounds like good business practice. The fact is, many foreign automobile manufacturers were actually moving plants and jobs to the United States at the same time. How were they able to do this? They were not saddled by 80 to 100 years of negotiations with labor unions. At each step along the way, for the most part, management resisted building more fuel-efficient vehicles. Honestly, in many ways, American consumers preferred the big gas guzzlers to the smaller fuel-efficient cars, at least until the last 10 years or so. GM had a jump start on the electric vehicle and brought out a new model in 2000. Unfortunately, it fell flat on its face. Rather than scrapping just the car and moving forward with its lofty technology lead, GM decided to scrap the entire concept, opening the door for Toyota to leap ahead with the development of the Prius, which, you know, if you've been around, know that's fairly popular. GM hopes that its Volt, that's V-O-L-T, Volt car, due out late next year in 2011, can recapture some of the green market. The list of mistakes by management throughout the year goes on and on. Fast forward to 2005, when it became evident to many that GM was in a downward spiral leading to a black hole. Had it filed for bankruptcy in 2005, when the economy and GM were both much stronger, it might have been able to restructure in such a way that the government would not be such a large shareholder. Bondholders would not be losing so much. The impact of the jobs would not have been nearly as great. Why? The economy was much stronger in 2005 than it is in 2009. As a result, a lot of bad things that eventually played out would likely not have occurred, or at least would have not been as severe. The same could be said going forward. The lessons for management are numerous, but managing from a point of arrogance never seems to work in the long run. In the bankruptcy filing, the government is going to invest $30.1 billion in addition to almost $20 billion it has already given GM. The Ontario and Canadian governments are contributing another $9.5 billion and will also be shareholders in GM. GM will likely sell its good assets to a new company. Those good assets include Chevrolet, Cadillac, Buick, and GMC brands, and they will likely leave behind the bad assets in the bankrupt company. Assuming GM can come back to profitability and drive its stock price up, the government, as a major stockholder, could see some portion of the investment returned to them. This is a significant part of President Obama's long-term plan. He says he wants to get out of the automobile business as quickly as possible. This is good news because the federal government is not adept at running efficient businesses. To the president's credit, the government intends to hire executives from the public sector to run GM rather than government officials. Amen. We shall see how much meddling they do with their 60% stock ownership as time goes by. A couple years ago, GM sold 51% of GMAC, its financing arm. This hurt GM sales efforts as credit began to tighten. Rather than having the flexibility to lend money in the tightened market, the new managers of GMAC followed the lead of others and made it very difficult for consumers to get credit. It has been reported that 1 in 4 car buyers have been turned down for credit by GMAC over the last 6 months. Well, we'll follow this story as it continues to develop, but boy, it's a shocker, isn't it? GM, owned by the government, majority shareholder, just boggles the mind. Well, I thought this was interesting, some tidbits that I had gotten and wanted to share with you. And if you're part of the union, this isn't bashing the unions, but we do have to take a look at the free market system and what's going to happen moving forward and the cost involved. So anyway, you're listening to Paul Nichols, the Investor Coach. We'll be right back after the break.
Have you borrowed money from your 401k or 403b? Big mistake. Never borrow money from your retirement plan, no matter what. Many people think it's harmless, but it's anything but. First of all, your money you borrowed isn't just borrowed. It's actually removed from the plan. That means your account won't grow as much as it would have. Second, you have to repay the loan, and that means you're paying taxes twice on the same money. So never borrow from your retirement plan, and if you have to pay it back, right away. To learn more about investments, IRAs, retirement planning, mortgages, insurance planning, buying homes, eliminating non-preferred debt, and more. Call Paul at Financial Abundance, 814-867-5745. Or check out their website, financialabundanceinc.com. You don't need to know everything if you have a coach teaching you the few right things. Call Paul at 814-867-5745.
Welcome back. This is Paul Nichols, the Investor Coach. I hope this finds you all well on this Saturday morning. You're listening to FM Talk 103.7 and WBLF 970 AM. You're listening also to the third part of Coach's Corner. I'm sure you heard Tim Rogers this morning and Ken Pasch. And then we bat cleanup in Coach's Corner. Coach's Corner was designed to pull back the curtain in our respective industries and give people some information, some truths, if you will. Pull back the curtain and expose the real deal. And that's exactly what we do every Saturday as it relates to finances. You know what I wanted to do? At GM took up most of that segment in the last segment that we had. So I want to share a couple more little news tidbits that I picked up that I think that you would find interesting. And then we're going to get into some of the 20 must-answer questions for creating lasting peace of mind. Here's one I thought was interesting. HSAs, health savings accounts. It's something I have myself, personally. HSAs are really high-deductible plans that allow you to put money away in the plans tax-free. And it can grow tax-free. It needs to be used for medical expenses. But HSAs are becoming more and more popular. And it says here, although HSAs are likely to come under fire this summer as the Senate begins debate on health care reform, it's good to know that the IRS anticipates an increase in the deductible contributions for 2010. Every year, the deductible goes up higher, according to IRS numbers, and that allows you to put more money tax-free into that account. So let's say, for example, you had a $5,000 deductible. You could. You didn't have to, but you could put $5,000 into the health savings account, HSA, health savings account. Some of your money goes toward the premium of insurance, and the rest goes your deductible. You can put that away every year if you'd like. But so they raise it for family coverage, okay? The contributions will rise to $6,150 or $6,150, and for single plans, $3,050. People born prior to 1956 will be able to put in an additional $1,000, kind of like an IRA catch-up type of deal. In order to qualify for an HSA, you must have a high deductible, so the deductible will increase as well, going to $2,400 for a family plan and $1,200 for a single plan. Correspondingly, the out-of-pocket costs will rise, going to $5,950 for single plans and $11,900 for family plans. HSAs are a great deal now. If you're with an employer, you probably wouldn't want to do it. If you're self-employed, HSAs are a great, great program. Another little tidbit here. In the middle of June, it's the middle of June, almost toward the end of June, 2009. Do you know where your $17,000 in federal benefits are? It is estimated that in 2009, every U.S. household will be receiving $17,000 in benefits from the government. Where? I don't know where it's at, but this could come in the form of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, unemployment insurance, tax credits. This is the highest percentage of benefits since 1929, the first year in the government even kept records of this type. When you translate it into actual income, it means that one in every $6 is coming from the government. Well, you know, for those of you receiving Social Security and Medicare, rightly so. And Medicaid, of course, food stamps, unemployment, tax credits. Wow, I don't think I'm seeing much of this action. I venture to say most of you aren't seeing much of it either. Well, it finally happened. There's a new derivative out. It is a stock that has been traded on the London Stock Exchange since December, and it is up 24% since opening. The company is Juridica. J-U-R-I-D-I-C-A, Juridica. Juridica? Hedge funds. What do? They invest in lawsuits. That's right. Many plaintiffs don't have enough money to pursue a lawsuit. As a result, attorneys are sometimes reluctant to take on a case without some reasonable opportunity of being paid. Enter Judicia Investments. They will put up the money for lawsuits, which they believe to be successful. You better have a really good case, though, because in last year, they only made 17 investments on roughly 120 cases that they reviewed. By putting up the money, Juridica, I can't even pronounce that. This company participates in the awards granted should the plaintiff win. Needless to say, this raises several potential ethical issues, including who are the attorneys and who do they really represent. Nonetheless, it's simply another way to make an alternative investment. Derivatives, you probably want to stay away from them unless you're a very sophisticated, highly knowledgeable, and high-risk tolerant investor. It's better just to own a well-diversified portfolio and forget about it. Unless you want to gamble a little bit, then you can do that, I guess. The GM fiasco has spilled over into other areas like the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which kicked out GM after 83 years. It's been replaced by Cisco Systems, which certainly gives the Dow a larger technology bend than it had in the past. At the same time, however, Citigroup was also ousted and replaced by Travelers Insurance Company. The irony here is that Citigroup had acquired Travelers and was its parent company for a number of years and was spun out several years ago. Thus, the Dow is swapping one financial company for another. Well, that's kind of the news update on what's going on with some tidbits. Let's get into one of my favorite subjects, which is creating peace of mind. Many people say to me, Paul, how can you say that you can create peace of mind when it comes to investing? Well, because I know there's only about 20 things you really need to know in order to be a studious, savvy, intelligent investor. And this stuff is information that's not unattainable, but you need to work toward it. And that's where we come in. That's why we do investor education every quarter. That's why we have many investor modules that we send to our clients that they can go online from the leisure of their home and do study modules. That's why we believe in an academic approach. And, you know, there's only 20 questions. We call it the 20 must-answer questions for lasting peace of mind. And I'm going to dig into this a little bit and just share some of these things with those of you listening out there. And we may not be able to get to all of them, but the intent is I'm going to lay some questions on you, and then I'm going to answer them for you. So I'm sure that you're going to pick up some nuggets along the way. And if you happen to be just hanging around the house, having another cup of coffee this morning, grab a pencil and pad. You might be able to take some notes. Now, if you're in the car, you probably don't want to do that. That's pretty profound, huh? Let's talk about, and these aren't in any order. I'm just going to bounce around. Well, the first question is, are you invested in the market? Do you own stocks or preferably stock-based mutual funds? Most investors can answer yes to this, so that's a pretty easy one. Are you invested in the market? That's one of the 20 must-answer questions. Well, that's a simple yes for most of us. Here's another one. Do you know how markets work? Yes or no? Do you know how markets work? While most investors answer that they do have money in the market, very few can honestly say they truly understand the dynamics of how free markets price securities. They are, in effect, ignorant of the forces that ultimately determine their investing results. You can easily see how having wealth in something that you do not understand would be extremely disturbing, especially when the markets take large losses. Ladies and gentlemen, never put money into something you don't truly understand, and that includes the stock market. That includes your 401. K and IRA and all those. If you don't understand, folks, you need to take a step back and learn. It's your advisor's or your coach's job to answer some of these questions and get them focused on getting you to understand where do returns come from in the market? How do you develop a well-diversified portfolio? What are the pros and cons? What is the science? Not somebody's opinion, not some research department's opinion. What's the facts? What's the fact, Jack? Number three, we hit on this a little bit earlier, not number three, but another one, number three this morning here. And this one is vital, ladies and gentlemen. I talked about it earlier. Have you defined your investment philosophy? Have you defined your investment philosophy? See, everyone knows it's important to have basic philosophies in life to simplify making complex decisions. For example, it's critical to have a basic underlying philosophies of religion and business, education, and even maybe the nature of good and evil. Most people do not even know it is impossible to have a philosophy when it comes to the field of investing. It is possible and critical to success. Most people choose an investment strategy without the understanding the underlying philosophy. To be successful, a philosophy must be developed and instituted first. There are two basic market philosophies. One, the market works, and one, the market fails. Now, folks, why this is so important? If you believe the market is efficient, okay, you would never stock pick market time and track record invest. You wouldn't gamble and chase the market. You would probably own an index fund of some kind or a whole group of index funds. You would believe the market's efficient, you would hold it. But if you believe the market was inefficient, you would never own an index fund. You would constantly be chasing the market and rebalancing. Folks, most people have no idea that they need to determine before they even start down the road of understanding their portfolio and how to invest. You need to adopt one philosophy or the other. And this is where the turmoil comes in. See, if you don't understand that you need to adopt one philosophy or the other, well, then you really have no foundation for what you're building your investments on. And you're always going to have, what's the word I'm looking for? You're always going to have a disconnect between your philosophy and the way your portfolio is designed. That's going to create a lack of peace of mind. And what we're trying to do is create peace of mind. Well, let me move on. Here's another one. This one's huge. Do you know how to measure diversification in your portfolio? We talked about that this morning. We talk about it every week during our market update. Everyone knows it's prudent to diversify, but how do you measure it? Academic and economic scientists use a very specific measuring tool called correlation to determine if your portfolio has been properly built. If you do not know specifically, chances are you are not truly diversified. In the typical portfolio, assets tend to move in a step rate fashion so that when one crashes, they all crash. To do it right, you must measure diversification in your portfolio. Remember the story, suntan lotion and umbrella companies. If you buy one of those stocks, what Markowitz figured out when he won the Nobel Prize for Modern Portfolio Theory, if you buy one by itself, it could be risky. But by buying two because they have dissimilar price movement, you've increased your return and lowered your risk. Boy, time flies when I get into this stuff. Here's another one. Do you consistently and predictively achieve market returns? Most people don't even know what market returns are, which is why we do the market update every week. You can't just look at the Dow. You can't just look at the S&P unless you only own large U.S. companies. If you own anything else, what's the gauge by which you can check it? Your first step is to analyze your current holdings to see if they have consistently held up to the returns to the asset categories that they are supposedly replicating. The odds are against you. You have probably lost to the market. It's easy to find managers who have had top performance in the past. It is all but impossible to pick them in advance with any consistency. Boy, I'm running out of time here. A little bit of time left. How much time do I have? Well, just to be safe here, let me just end it there because I got about a minute left.